This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Nick Swartzel, filling in for host Lucy May. For 50 years, and until a few hours ago, Americans lived with certain federal protections for abortion access in all 50 states. But that ended today when the U.S. Supreme Court released a decision that effectively overturned its 1973 ruling in Roe v. Wade. Its decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, a case out of Mississippi, means that conservative states like Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana can now pass more restrictive abortion regulations. 13 states have already passed outright bans, ready to go. That likely represents an enormous shift in America's cultural and political landscape. Today, we'll have multiple guests on the show, advocates for abortion access, those who have worked to end abortions, and experts on the legal and societal implications for today's decision to help us understand those changes. First, we're joined by Pro-Choice Ohio Deputy Director Jamie Miracle. Thanks for being with us, Jamie.
Thank you for having me.
First, just talk to us about the immediate reaction to this huge news today. This is a very big decision that just came down.
Yes. I mean, like you said at the beginning of the show, this overturned 50 years of precedence. For the last 50 years, people across this country could count on our laws protecting access to abortion care, and they can no longer do that. I think for a lot of folks, this is a shock. For others, it's deep grief, fear. There are all kinds of emotions around today. I think a lot of folks, you know, like us, knew that this was coming, but seeing it in black and white, seeing the words in a Supreme Court decision stating that the finding is that Roe and Casey are overruled, is going to be a big shift in our country.
So there's the emotional and the sort of visceral reaction to it. What does this mean in real terms for those who might be seeking abortions in Ohio today or into the near future?
Today, nothing has changed. There are lots of states across this country that have things called trigger laws that would go into effect immediately. Ohio is not one of those states. So immediately here in Ohio, abortion access today looks just like abortion access looked yesterday. Going forward, Attorney General Dave Yost has already, at the behest of Governor Mike DeWine, filed a request in federal court to lift the injunction that's blocking our six-week ban from going into effect. That will have to go through the court's process. That will probably take 3 or 4 weeks. At the end of that, that injunction will most likely, based on this decision out of the Supreme Court today, be lifted. So looking into the future, Ohio is probably looking at 3 or 4 weeks down the line having a ban on abortion at about 6 weeks of pregnancy in effect in the state.
Talk to us about some of the implications beyond just abortion being illegal. What does that mean for people who are able to give birth?
That's a really good question, because so many people do just look at the impact that this will have on people seeking abortion care. But the reaches of this are far beyond that. When we look at people experiencing complications during pregnancies, either in the pregnant person's health or with the fetal health, when the six-week ban goes into effect in Ohio, doctors will be severely restricted on what kind of care that they can give to their pregnant patients. And in the ruling today as well, Clarence Thomas, in a concurring opinion, not the main opinion, but one of the concurring opinions, talked about how the court should actually go and revisit things like Obergefell, which legalized gay marriage in the United States, or Lawrence versus Texas, which decriminalized sexual acts between same-sex partners. This could impact access to IVF. This could impact access to birth control. The reaches of the decision today won't be fully known for years to come, really. But in the immediate time, like when a physician is treating a pregnant person in crisis, Ohio's laws, once the six-week ban goes into effect, will severely tie their hands in being able to take care of the patients that they should be able to take care of, and will send people out of state for health care they need.
Speaking of this out-of-state issue, in some states there's been talk of legislation that would try to prohibit people seeking abortions from crossing state lines to do so. Are you concerned about that kind of legislation in Ohio, or are you hearing anything about that?
We haven't heard anything about that, but what we've seen out of anti-abortion groups in Ohio is that they will stop at nothing. They will try everything they can to stop people from getting access to the abortion care they need and deserve. And so I would not be surprised to see a whole host of new bills be introduced to try to block people from getting access to abortion care. We've seen, they were considering a trigger ban, like I talked about earlier, that would have banned abortion at the moment the decision came down. We have pending in the Ohio legislature a copycat bill to what existing in Texas, which actually puts a $10,000 bounty on the head of anybody who performs an abortion in Ohio. And so the gerrymandered anti-abortion majority in our state legislature has shown before that they will stop at nothing to block people from getting access to the health care they need. And I would expect no different from them, especially after this case today.
So abortion access has been a huge part of our political landscape in Ohio and in the nation for decades now. Do you see this decision causing a big shift in our politics? What do you think of those broader implications in terms of beyond healthcare?
I think there has been, and I don't think that this decision is going to change the political nature of it. If anything, it is going to make it even more political. And we've started to see a shift in polling with more and more people identifying as pro-choice and supporting abortion access and abortion rights than opposing abortion access and abortion rights. As we've moved through the last 6 months, and especially in the last month after the leaked opinion that came out of the Supreme Court last month. And so, more people are now realizing that the Supreme Court that they kind of relied on to protect access to abortion care and had protected abortion access for the last 50 years can't be counted on anymore. And that really puts all of the power back in the hands of elected officials here in the state. Not only the governor and attorney general and members of the legislature, but Ohio also elects our Supreme Court justices, our state Supreme Court justices. And those three of those positions will be on the ballot this fall as well. And the members of the Ohio Supreme Court will really be the group of people who decide whether or not abortion access continues in Ohio or ends in Ohio.
Yeah. I want to kind of pivot to a question that might be hard for you on this first day, but I just want to go here. What does the future of abortion access advocacy look like post-Roe? And will this change how Pro-Choice Ohio goes about its mission?
Absolutely not. We are here. We are here to stay, and we are here to keep fighting for as long as it takes to either preserve access to abortion or to reestablish it if a ban were to go into effect. Today, we are even more determined to continue to fight to make sure that every single Ohioan and person across our region and our country have access to the abortion care that they need, and we will do everything in our power to make sure that that happens. There are lots of plans that were being put into place and will be put into place moving forward out of today's decision. The only plan we don't have is to give up.
I see. Do you have any thoughts for Ohioans who will be seeking abortions after this ruling? Where are people to go? What is the, direction that people need to go to figure this out?
Well, for right now, they can still access abortion care at the 9 clinics that we have across the state. They can find where those clinics are on our website at prochoiceohio.org/clinics. There are 9 clinics, 6 of which provide full-service abortion care procedures and medication abortion, and 3 additional ones that provide medication abortion care only. Those are in cities like Cincinnati, Dayton, Columbus, the Akron area, the Cleveland area, and Toledo. And so, you know, people can still get access to the care they need at those clinics. As we move forward, they're going to have to travel out of state, and a lot of people are going to need help to do that. And in Ohio, there are 3 abortion funds that provide funding for the abortion procedure and also to help patients get access to the care with transportation and hotel and other other things like that. There are Women Have Options, which is a statewide abortion fund, the Agnes Reynolds Jackson Fund in the Toledo area, and Preterm Fund in the Cleveland area. So all of those places are great ways to figure out like how to get access to the care folks need today. But again, today, they can still get access to abortion care at the 9 clinics that exist in our state.
I see. Do you see any movement in the future toward, a state where, abortion rights are protected more, or is Ohio going to be a place where it's going to be difficult to find that?
Luckily, Ohio does have some remedies to establish abortion as a right, either in our constitution via a ballot initiative or through actions through our state Supreme Court, like we talked about before. Not every state has that. And so, of course, you know, as we're thinking about moving forward, we're looking at every single option. Because, like I said, we're not going to stop until abortion access is a reality and or stays a reality in our state. And we'll do everything we can to do that.
I've been talking with Pro-Choice Ohio Deputy Director Jamie Maracle. Thanks for being here, Jamie.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Nick Swartzell, filling in for host Lucy May. While a number of Americans have been engaged in an effort to preserve abortion access in states like Ohio, others have fought hard to end its legality on moral grounds. That movement has deep roots in the Buckeye State. Joining us to talk about what today means for those opposed to abortion and what comes next for the movement with Roe gone is Greater Cincinnati Right to Life Executive Director Laura Streetman. Thanks so much for joining us, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
First, what does this day mean for you and your organization? You know, after almost 50 years, Roe is gone, and that seems like a big thing for Right to Life.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. Let's remember that Cincinnati Right to Life was one of the very first pro-life organizations founded in this nation by Dr. Jack Wilkie and his wife, Barbara, who are considered the pioneers of the pro-life movement. Even before abortion was legal in all 50 states, all 9 months, let's remember what we're talking about, you know, again, the word abortion, the killing of preborn children in our country. Dr. Jack Wilkie and his wife Barbara knew what was going on in Colorado, California, New York, and they just obviously had a calling and just were shocked at the atrocity that people were discussing, making abortion legal, the law of the land. So they actually founded Ohio Right to Life, moved that to Columbus, and then founded Cincinnati Right to Life in 1971. And then the second branch of our organization was founded in 1973, which was our educational branch. So we operate a 501c3 and a 501c4, founded in 1971 and 1973. So yes, we've been fighting this for over 50 years. It's been a long 50 years.
Yeah. So you got to my next question, which was going to be the deep roots you have in Cincinnati. Tell me about, you know, over those decades, abortion has been a huge contentious issue in America. In your mind, does this ruling suggest a change in the political landscape, either leading up to the ruling or now that it's happened?
Well, I think that America has always been pro-life. We know that Ohio is pro-life, especially right now. You know, we have a supermajority in both the House and the Senate in our state of Ohio, the heart of it all, right? And let's not forget that we were the first state to pass a heartbeat bill and to respect life. And there's just waves, depending on how elections go and then how judges are appointed. And so do I expect something new? I believe that we have always been a pro-life nation, and there have been some really bad, and as Justice Alito wrote today, egregious laws enacted in our country, considering that our Constitution says life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The word abortion is not in our Constitution anywhere, but the word life is many times.
Now that Roe is overturned, does that change your organization's approach or the focus that you're going to take? What's next for the Right to Life movement?
It's a big question. And because none of us knew how this decision was going to come down, we had a feeling based off the leak and what we had heard, and we believed truly that this greatest injustice in America was going to be overturned. So we've had time to think. We've had time to pray. As I mentioned in the beginning, we've always been about education. We got to this place in history because people are miseducated. And ultrasounds are very different in 2022 than they were in 1972. And we need to re-educate the world on what a human person is. It's the highest creation in the world. You know, there's a reason that the person was created on the sixth day and is very good by God, whether you're a believer or not, no matter what your branch of faith is. It's in the Old Testament, in Scripture. And while we're a secular organization per se, we are many believers that fight this fight. So it's going to be about re-educating the culture. And we know we're going to have to still stay very involved in politics. We know that elections are still going to matter, judges are going to matter, and laws are going to matter. We're going to have to fight harder than ever to keep this law in place and at the local level, too, to keep our local laws leaning towards life, which is the truth.
So tell me, there's a person out there who's young and they have been thinking about seeking an abortion or something like that. They're scared right now, maybe. What do you say to them? You know, like, how do we start to bridge the divide that this issue has caused in this country?
It's a great question, and that's where we need to begin. We need to begin with mercy, empathy, and understanding. I worked on the front lines at a pregnancy center for 10 years and helped probably thousands of women. I mean, 800 women annually sought services there. And we have to remember that life is the truth, and that when a woman is expecting a child, she's not maybe going to be a mother. She already is a mother. And we know that the child inside her is not a parasite. We know it is a person with their own blood type, their own DNA. We know an unborn baby's heart begins 18 days after conception. And we know how early that her unborn baby looks exactly like a baby, the baby that will be born someday at 40 weeks. And it's been a lie for all these years that this is not a person. So what we say to her is, you're scared. Take a deep breath. You are a mother, and it's exciting. And this life inside you is a gift. And maybe you're in school, maybe you have a bad relationship with the father or the baby, or no relationship. Maybe you've had hard times in your life. But there is a massive support system in the greater Cincinnati community. And around the United States, there are over 2,000 free pregnancy help centers. And we don't walk with the woman at the time of the decision, just at that moment. We stay with her throughout the life of the child. I began that work 15 years ago, and I am still friends with many of the women that came into my life as they were making a decision about their unborn baby. We care about the mother, maybe even more than we care about the unborn child, because we know it's a heart-wrenching decision for her, and things in her life don't have to be perfect in order for the life of that child to end up being perfectly timed to be in her life. And I would say that she needs to pick up the phone and call Option Line and get some help. And there are people that are just waiting to serve you. And what may seem like the worst thing in the world, an unexpected pregnancy, may turn out to be the best thing that ever happened to her. And we are there to support her with that.
One of the observations advocates for abortion access make is that there isn't enough support out there for people who become parents. I think this kind of like segues into what you were talking about, that it's harder than ever to raise a family. Do you think there needs to be more done for young families? And is that an area where there might be some agreement on these sides?
Yes, I completely agree with that. And I think where the agreement comes in as well, and just from having sat through many hearings and courtrooms and, you know, hearing the opposition argue, I think where the agreement is that we want to serve and we want to help. It's just that pro-lifers don't believe that taking the life of the unborn child is helping. We believe in supporting life as the help. So, yes, we can. It's a time in history where we need to get more laws enacted, where we have paid family leave, you know, leading women to the right health care options and the support that's out there, and be ready to serve. We do. And even adoption, the adoption laws need to be reformed so that adoption is not so expensive. I mean, the biggest lie out there as well is that, you know, these children are going to wind up in foster care. And that's just not true. If a woman chooses life and makes an adoption plan, there are many adoption attorneys that are there ready to serve for free so that that child is immediately placed in a home with an adoptive mother and father at the birth of that child. There is no foster care system when an adoption plan is made for that child.
Talk to me a little bit more about what those supports might look like. Are you envisioning the policy decisions that are made? Is this more of something in the nonprofit sphere? You know, how do we increase that support for people?
I think it's a both and. This isn't one or the other. It's a both and. The policies need to change, and then we need to do more as a community. I can honestly say to you that in the pro-life movement, in the pregnancy center movement, there are times where women have not been able to make a car payment. They haven't been able to pay their energy bill or their tuition or something. 100% of the time, I have seen pro-lifers and support people step up and help these women over humps so that they can get through having, you know, their baby. Maybe it's a difficult time. But we also need policies, again, paid family leave policies that are advantageous towards women having babies so they can take the time off, not lose their income. There was an op-ed that appeared in the Cincinnati Enquirer this past Sunday on tax credits. There are some fiscally conservative plans out there to give mothers and fathers tax credits so they can stay home with their children and, you know, be able to take the time they need to heal from having a baby. And, you know, this is the greatest country in the world, right? America is. And we have wonderful schools, and we just need to step up and do more. Taking the life of an unborn child solves nothing. It's created a nation with many grieving people, and I just reach my hands out to you with nothing but mercy and empathy if you've lost a child through an abortion decision. There are many post-abortive healing groups out there as well, and I believe it's going to be a time that we are going to discover that there are more and more people that are going to share their grief with the world now that we've seen an end to Roe.
I've been talking with Greater Cincinnati Right to Life Executive Director Laura Streetman. Thanks so much for joining us, Laura.
Thank you.
This is Cincinnati Edition. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 97.1 WVXU. I'm Nick Swartzel, filling in for host Lucy May. Abortion has long been an ideological battleground in America, but the Supreme Court's decision today effectively striking down Roe v. Wade has some far-reaching legal and real-life implications as well. Joining us to talk about that is University of Cincinnati College of Law Dean Verna Williams. Welcome, Dean Williams.
Thank you.
We also have University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of Sociology and Ohio Policy Evaluation Network co-principal investigator Dr. Danielle Bissett. Welcome, Dr. Bissett.
Thank you so much, Nick. Glad to be here with you.
Dean Williams, walk us through briefly what this decision means in terms of legal precedent and the Constitution. I know that's like a huge question, but let's just get into it.
It's a huge question, and particularly for somebody who hasn't had an opportunity to read the entire decision.
I read the
draft opinion, the leaked opinion, but in a nutshell, from what I've been able to discern, this is a major reversal, and it's a major setback. Reversing Roe and Casey strikes down 50 years of precedent, 50 years of reliance on the ability to make decisions about when to or whether to have children. And it brings into question lots of rights that are that were equally implied in the Constitution, notwithstanding the fact that the Justice Alito suggested those are very different and there's no need to fear. I think that there is a reason for people to be quite concerned about such things as the the right to same-sex marriage, the right to contraceptives, the right to reside in a family formation of one's choosing, just to name a few rights that the Constitution doesn't mention. Make no mistake about it, this is a major, major decision.
Talk to me a little bit more, and again, knowing you haven't read the full opinion, but I think there's a lot in there that we can talk about in terms of some of these other rights. Why should we be worried about the right to privacy, for instance, or the right to birth control?
Well, the courts, one of the major reasons that the majority strikes down Roe and Casey is that the Constitution is silent about abortion. Well, the Constitution is also silent about privacy. It is silent about contraceptives. The court first recognized the right to privacy in a case called Griswold versus Connecticut. And that's a case where a married couple challenged Connecticut's law that prohibited contraception way back, starting from, with laws back in the 1870s. And the court said, you know, these laws go too far. They enter a realm that they don't belong in. And how was the state contemplating enforcing these? By going into married couples' bedrooms? Well, you know, of course that's ridiculous. And the court found a right to privacy in a number of different places. What they call the penumbra, which is recognizing that there are different aspects of the Bill of Rights that imply a right to privacy. Take the Fourth Amendment, for example, the right unreasonable searches and seizures, right, to protect you against unreasonable searches and seizures. That suggests that a person has a right to be in their home and not have the state interfere with their privacy in the home. And in addition to those other amendments, there's the Ninth Amendment, which is basically the catch-all, which says despite the fact that there's a right isn't listed here, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means we haven't identified it yet. So, you know, the court easily could have found a right to privacy there, but they located it in a number of different places. And so the fact that the court makes much of the fact that abortion's not mentioned, overturning decades and decades and decades of principles upon which the court has relied and upon which the American people have relied in, as I said, getting contraception, marrying people of different races, same-sex marriage, things of that nature.
I want to get back to the legal implications in a minute, but I also want to turn to you, Dr. Bissett. You know, you're a part of this Ohio Policy Evaluation Network, which has done a lot of research about abortion access. And can you talk to me about some of that research that might be really relevant right now as we look at the end of Roe?
Thanks, Nick. Yes, with Professor Allison Norris at The Ohio State University, I co-lead OPEN, which is a collective of Ohio social scientists and other scholars. And our goal at OPEN is to improve health outcomes and uphold autonomy for Ohioans by providing impartial data and evidence about the impact of policy on reproductive health care. So we've conducted a number of studies, and I want to just highlight three briefly here that touch on that seem most relevant to today's decision. So first, we have found that a majority of Ohio women of reproductive age support abortion access in Ohio. And this finding is consistent with several other polls of Ohioans more generally. And it suggests that the existing and proposed restrictions in Ohio that you just heard about from Pro-Choice Ohio are not consistent with the public opinions of Ohioans. Second study I want to highlight is that, you know, if an abortion ban were to go into effect in Ohio, Ohioans would have to travel out of state for abortion care. That would be one of the options that would face pregnant people seeking to end their pregnancies. We did an analysis and we found that this would result in huge increases in driving distances you know, sort of, and all the costs, of course, that go along with increased travel for gas, for hotel, for time off work, for childcare. Notably, we found that Black Ohioans would experience the greatest increase in travel. And so there are issues of equity here, too. And then the third study I want to just highlight is that we have found that clinicians who provide reproductive health care, but who do not provide abortion care, right? So obstetric gynecologists, specialists, genetic counselors, and others, they're already affected by Ohio's existing restrictions in ways that they feel keep them from being able to provide care that their patients need. And this is actually going to become far more challenging for those clinicians. And it's why major medical professional organizations are strongly against abortion bans. So Ohioans and, you know, OPEN urge Ohio lawmakers really to draw on empathy for the people who are seeking care, to draw on the vast amount of scientific evidence that supports the need for abortion access, and also to consider their constituents' views toward abortion, which are pro-choice.
Thanks, Dr. Bissett. One question I have is, you talked a little bit about the sort of disparate impact of a potential abortion ban in Ohio. Why do some of those disparities exist? Like, what makes it more difficult for some people than others to access that particular, you know, service?
Well, I mean, of course, I mean, I think the existing inequalities, both economic and those produced by structural racism, really inform this whole discussion, of course. So we know that, I mean, really, if you think about what would happen to a person who is pregnant and would like to terminate a pregnancy, all of the options facing them would have implications around inequality. So for people who want to travel out of state, that means that they need to have resources. It also means that for those who are able to make the journey but have to spend a large amount of their household income on that, that those economic impacts may last for years to come. For folks who do not get an abortion, of course, you know, we know not only, you know, will that decision be shaped by the resources that people have to get care, but also, you know, the wonderful Turnaway study that was out of the University of California at San Francisco ANSWER program. They found that, you know, economic insecurity was increased for those who carried a pregnancy to term compared to those who were able to secure the abortion that they wanted. And, you know, lastly, we know, you know, some folks will self-source abortion, meaning that they will procure abortion either through pills online or other methods that they seek outside the medical establishment. And, you know, unfortunately, we know already that Black Americans are disproportionately criminalized for pregnancy-related crimes. And so, again, that structural racism that we already see is likely to affect those who are being faced with you know, sort of options that may no longer be strictly legal.
So, and I think this question is for both of you, but I'll stick with Dr. Bissett at first. Assuming that Ohio does enact an abortion ban, you know, I think some of these implications are going to affect people of color, you know, people who may have less access to resources. What are some of the policy decisions that like our lawmakers are going to have to think about in terms of creating a safety net to deal with those implications?
Well, look, I think that there's excellent evidence that we need strong improvements to the safety net regardless of what happens with abortion's legality or legal status in Ohio. However, those kinds of ameliorations do not replace the need for access to abortion. And, you know, I think a couple weeks ago on this very program, you had my colleague Michelle McGowan and some other scholars who spoke about really the importance of recognizing that the need for abortion doesn't go away because it is no longer legal. The need for abortion persists regardless, and people need access that is safe and sort of provides them with the options that they need.
Dean Williams, I know you're a legal scholar, and maybe sort of like legislation isn't where you're thinking right now, but are there things that you can think of, policy decisions that might need to be made, should Ohio ban abortion?
Well, one thing I would say is that I would urge the legislature to include an exception for the health or life of the mother. The court used to say that used to be constitutionally required. And under the kinds of laws, let's say Texas and those that are in other states, as Dr. Bissett noted, physicians are wary provide the procedure when it's necessary to save the mother's life, or when the pregnancy is jeopardizing the mother's life. And for example, you can think of cases in which the fetus has died, and there's a risk of sepsis, which could kill the mother. And there are sadly countless instances in which women have died in other countries because the laws are very stringent, akin to what we've seen in Texas, and don't provide an exception for the life or health of the mother. And so you're losing the fetal life has already been extinguished, but now the mother is gone. I would want to see that. In addition, I would just say that there, as Dr. Bissett has already noted, there are numerous laws that our state house could enact that would make parenting and pregnancy much more make it easier and would be friendly to families. For example, we know that discrimination against pregnant people happens very commonly in the workplace, that some workplaces are unwilling to accommodate pregnant people's simple request for a glass of water. We know that quality childcare is difficult to find and expensive. Well, if this is a pro-life state, then let's make sure that we're providing affordable childcare people working in all different realms of life can afford. Likewise, healthcare. As Dr. Bissett has noted, structural racism and inequalities in economic capacity means that healthcare frequently is unavailable to families. Let's do something about that. And then the last thing I think about is infant mortality. The U.S. is sadly one of the leading nations in infant mortality, and I mean that in not a good way. There are far too many babies and that are outside the womb who have died because of lack of care. And Ohio is one of those places as well. And indeed, Hamilton County has a very high level of infant mortality. So if the legislature wants to take this tack that we're very pro-life, then let's support families. Let's support mothers. Let's make sure that, infant formula is available, among other things.
Dean Williams, are you seeing in other states that might be more pro, allowing abortion? Are you seeing a shoring up of protections for abortion access as states like Ohio might be clamping down on it?
Yeah, there have been a couple of states that I've noted their leaders have come out and said we will be a shelter, that's not the word, a haven or a place that you can come and have your abortion and don't have to worry about law enforcement. So yeah, a number of states have already said that.
Dr. Bissett, a similar question for you. Are you seeing that there are places where abortion is being protected more because of what we've been seeing over the past number of months?
Yes, there are a number of states, California, New York, and others that have, Illinois, that have really recognized the importance of access to abortion care, that are working very hard to make this sort of available to folks from out of state. Lots of clinics in those destination states ramping up to try to be able to accommodate care, because of course this is going to have ripple effects for their clients as well. Folks who would normally be able to obtain an abortion may have to wait longer because of the influx of patients from other states. Also, your speaker from Pro-Choice Ohio also mentioned abortion funds. And of course, abortion funds like Women Have Options Ohio and other abortion funds are also ramping up to try to make sure that people who might not otherwise be able to afford to travel across to other states would be able to have the resources in order to make that travel.
Both of you are in higher education, and like, how do you talk to people who might be students or young about this decision? Like, what do you say about the enormity of this? And I'll start with you, Dean Williams. How do you talk to young people who might just be entering the legal, studies profession? How do you talk to them about it?
That's a really difficult question, Nick, and I was hoping that you were going to start with Dr. Bassett.
Sorry about that.
It is a difficult, it's a difficult issue. I think that we would have to. Right now, it's the summer, and all of our students are out, working, getting legal experience at different types of organizations. They no doubt are paying attention to this, and some of them may even be listening today. What I say to students, we would look at the decision, and we would critically examine the court's analysis. We would ask questions about the extent to which the court's reasoning made sense or was consistent with prior precedent. We would approach it that way, like a legal problem, certainly in class. If there was an appetite on the part of students to hear more, and that we had like a broader discussion, I certainly could imagine something like this program, where you'd have different speakers come and talk about what the decision means for pregnant women in the state of Ohio, what it means for other laws to protect, what should the legislature do to protect unforeseen consequences and things of that nature. But how to address, and so I've just been, I think stalling, how to address the shock. I think, these are young people who know nothing but access to abortion in their short lives. This is a great reversal in how they've understood life. I don't have an answer for that. And I certainly would welcome the opportunity to discuss it with them and to talk about, their concerns and ways of moving forward.
Dr. Bassett, I have a similar question for you. How do you talk to people who are, students, young people who are maybe, probably never lived in a post-Roe or a world without Roe? We'll say it that way.
Yeah, I echo much of what Dean Williams has said. It is really hard. The classroom, of course, is one space in which we come to this as sociologists and as a sociologist, as a scholar, as a human being, I value autonomy and the ability of people to make sense of complex problems and challenges in their own ways. At the same time, we have to deal with the evidence, right? That is, as sociologists, our job. And so we look at the evidence. One of the things I mentioned, for example, is that, the maternal mortality goes up when you carry a pregnancy to term. We know that is not equal by races, and that folks who are Black Ohioans have higher rates of maternal mortality. And it's really hard then, to escape the ways in which, we look at the data and we see the inequities that will result from this decision, the hardship that will result from the decision when we look at this, again, vast and rigorous body of evidence that's available. I also think, you know, personally, I do a lot of mentoring. The draft decision came down just at the end of the semester, and I have met with a number of students since the draft decision. And, you know, to Dean Williams' point, really all I can do for them is to hold space for them. I'm now at a point in my life where I don't expect to face an unexpected pregnancy. Some of the folks that I talk to, are in tears, frankly, because they recognize that their options, their humanity, they feel has been devalued by the draft. And I'm sure now, once I get off the phone, I'll be later able to meet with some of the students I work with and learn about what this does feel like for them. But really, all I can do is hold space and continue to, you know, sort of work on the evidence base, because I have to believe that having better and more information will ultimately help us to produce policies that serve Ohioans best.
Thanks, Dr. Bissett. Dean Williams, I know this is another big question, and just in a couple minutes, can you tell us, like, how we got here? These kind of legal things don't just happen out of the blue. You know, there's a lot that leads up to it. How do we get to the point where a 50-year precedent was overturned?
Well, it's in a little by little. Ever since the Supreme Court decided Roe versus Wade, there has been a group of folks that opposed that decision, and they made their views known. They organized. They developed legal theories. They developed legal organizations whose mission was to eliminate abortion, and they came up with all kinds of legal strategies to limit it. So, you know, the fact that today the court has taken that final step, but honestly, before today, even before release of the leaked opinion, the right to abortion was so constrained in the country because of this march. So you had the heartbeat bills, for example, and bills that laws that required hallways to be a certain width. All of these things were intended to constrain the right to abortion, and it has been ultimately successful in its aims. That's how we got here. And now what will happen, I suspect, is that there'll be a campaign on the other side that's going to work similarly to get that right back and to find openings in the Supreme Court's decision and openings in state legislatures to preserve some aspect of the right. But it's going to be a really long struggle, a long, long battle. But we know, to end on a hopeful note, you know, that's how things change. I mean, that's how we got to this position. But if history is any indication, you know, this too shall pass.
I've been talking with University of Cincinnati College of Law Dean Verna Williams and UC Associate Professor of Sociology and Ohio Policy Evaluation Network Principal Investigator Dr. Danielle Bissett. Thank you so much for your time, Dean Williams and Dr. Bissett.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Nick, for sharing these views on this really important topic.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Rick Andrus. I'm Nick Swartzel. Talk to you Monday.